Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, our podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, we appreciate it. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, the Warriors are one of those we won't lose sorts of classics. Talk about that New Yorker article on analytics in the NBA that Jalen Rose is part of. But first, hey, man, I can't imagine what it is like to be Kevin Durant at this time. At the time of this recording, we don't know exactly what the injury is. They're going to the MRI. But I tell you this, if you tear your Achilles, they know it before you leave the building. And I feel like when you leave the building in the middle of the game, that means because you got some really, really, really bad news. And Durant appears to have received some really, really, really bad news before he took off out of the arena. And this is one of those I'm not sure where to begin sorts of things. Like, Durant himself has made a good point where he's just like, I feel like you guys are talking more about free agency than you are actually talking about basketball. Like, he wants to come out here and he wants to talk about basketball. And I get where he is coming from. But even with the Warriors pulling out that incredible win, even with this now being a 3-2 series and them having a chance to go again, with the basketball is as intriguing as it could have been. Dude, this is about Durant right now. I don't even know if it's about free agency necessarily, because that seems like, I mean, we'll get to that at some point. But when you see in a game where two guys who are starters are the ones that want to do back to the locker room, like when Paul Pierce did that ridiculous thing with the wheelchair, it was Brian Scalabrine carrying him out of there. It was Stephen Iguodala whose game was to get this dude back after this had happened. Kyle Lowry doesn't even play for the same team. He was so shook up that people had to calm him down, including Steph Curry, for what happened with Kevin Durant. I can only wonder what was going through DeMarcus Cousins' mind as he had basically lived this same exact situation a year before. I could not imagine anything worse, really, for Durant that did not involve him, like, literally dying. I could not. Think about this. We come out of game 4 into game 5 and we start hearing grumblings in reports about how, hey, Kevon Looney's out there playing. Iguodala, he had been a little banged up. He figured out how to get out there. Klay Thompson, he's back out there playing. Who's the other one? Cousins, he's back out there playing. How come Durant isn't out there playing? You had people in media start talking legacy stuff and how Durant needs to come out here and set the world on fire and everything else. Like, there was a pretty, like, sturdy level of pressure for Kevin Durant to come out here and play. And what blew my mind about that was the idea that anybody thought for a moment that if Kevin Durant could play, that he wouldn't. Like, that involves a level of cynicism that I think is unfair to ascribe to Kevin Durant. Did you really think for a second that if that dude was able to play basketball, that he wouldn't be out there playing basketball? Like, no matter who you are, if you're somebody that's, like, far removed from the Warriors, if you're somebody that's up close to him, I can't understand how you could dislike that dude so much. And I'm not the biggest fan of his, to be clear, but you have to have a pretty either staggering level of distaste for him to assume that if he could play, that he would not, in spite of it, or you just telling me about what kind of person you are and what your get down was. But I never thought for a second that if Durant was not out there, then he could really play and was just kind of camping out, waiting until free agency came around. And then next thing you know, after you get all this word out on the street about this and that and about Kevin Durant, next thing you know, he's walking into the arena, right? He's locked in. He's got the hood on. He's not looking up. When he walked past people, he is ready to go. And then he got out there on the court and he was on fire, 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 fire. 11 points in 12 minutes. He looked like the old Kevin Durant. Not even old, but it's only been a month since he played, but that's what he looked like. He was like, okay, cool. You got it. And then he was on the ground. And when he hit the ground, my immediate thought was, okay, well, it's the calf, right? If nothing else, I was not thinking about this in much longer term stuff than the series. I was like, okay, it's just a calf. I also did not entertain the possibility that it was a torn Achilles because he walked off the floor. Now, granted, I saw Kobe shoot the 2 free throws and walk off the floor, but there's normally not a lot of mystery to when somebody has an Achilles tear. The Achilles tear is recognized pretty immediately. That thing rolls up on the back of your leg. I figured that that was it. That, you know, we knew what the time was. But no, this turned out to be awful. And then he's walking out of there in a walking boot. And again, I'm not big on Twitter diagnosing. I don't think it's a great idea. None of us are actually doctors. I just don't recall nobody needing no walking boot for a calf injury. That was my thought. I had never seen nobody need no walking boot for a calf injury. Now, granted, I'm not that well-versed in the walking boot arts, but I had not seen anybody walk out of there in a walking boot just because something happened with his calf. And we had Steve Kerr after the game and Bob Myers. We're going to throw this thing to Bob Myers first. But Bob Myers, even if you didn't know exactly what was going on, I feel like you could hear it in Bob Myers' voice.
Kevin had it's an Achilles injury. I don't know the extent of it. He'll have an MRI tomorrow. Prior to coming back, he went through 4 weeks with our medical team, and it was thorough, and it was experts and multiple MRIs and multiple doctors, and we felt good about the process. He was cleared to play tonight. That was a collaborative decision.
I did not get a great handling, Gabe. You let me know. When he said it was a collaborative decision, who collaborated?
Yeah, that sounds like we collaborated with Rich Kleiman, Durant's manager, and Durant on this decision.
Or did they collaborate with the doctor? You know what I mean? Like, clearing somebody to play is not a collaborative decision, right? Like, if he was cleared to play, only the doctors could then go out there and clear him to play. And look, in the end, Durant made the decision to play. I would have problems if he felt pushed or nudged by the organization in order to do so, though I understand why under these circumstances they would push and nudge. But in the end, it was his decision to go out there and play. And I just hope for his own sake, I can't speak for nobody else, but I hope for his sake that he did not let these people bully him into playing. Because look, he's never, if this is an Achilles tear, he is never going to be the same. Period. You can like chalk up some people who have continued to play after suffering from Achilles injuries, and you can point to people who have been decent after Achilles injuries. But I feel like you can watch Boogie Cousins out here getting his shot blocked by short people, and you realize he will not be the same again. Right? Now, the question about whether Durant really belonged in this Warriors run and everything else. Hey, man, he gave like the last years of his prime for this championship, for their attempt to win it this time. He did that. They can't say a bad word about him. Like all these salty Warriors fans, you never really liked Kevin Durant that much in the first place. He gave y'all more than y'all ever deserved with this one. He did. There's no way around it. He gave y'all more than y'all ever deserved when he decided to go out there and keep playing on this injury. He did it. And I feel bad for him. Like, look, Kevin Durant ain't that happy to begin with. The one thing that does seem to give Kevin Durant some measure of happiness is playing basketball, right? That's it. Just simply playing basketball. It's looking like he's not going to be playing basketball for a year, at least. Gabe, you know how much time he's going to spend on the internet not playing?
Like 9 months?
9 months to a year. But you realize like how much time he's going to be like on the IG, on the burners? What we know about him, injuries are far more traumatic for athletes, especially serious injuries. They're far more traumatic for athletes than I think that people realize, because this is the thing you do. And now you cannot do this thing anymore. And this isn't like when he had the foot thing where, yeah, like foot injuries are tricky, but it was reasonable to think, all right, man, you're going to take your time. You're going to be back and you're going to be fine. Nobody can look this man with a straight face and just be like, no, everything's going to be cool. You're going to come back good as new. Nobody does that. Nobody has. You can't make that call on him. You can't. And so now he's going to have to go through dealing with himself and the idea that, man, I knew I shouldn't have played. I knew I shouldn't have played. He's going to have to deal with a certain level of anger that I'd be willing to guess that he holds toward the Warriors about trying to push him out there to play. He's got to have the anger toward those people who question whether or not he was able to play. All of those things have got to be there inside somebody who seems to be on a certain struggle to hold it together on a regular basis. Like, this is where he is. Like, this offseason, this is like the big Kevin Durant offseason. Everything I feel like that was supposed to happen for Kevin Durant to, like, really be a clear sign of his ascent to being, like, that guy. Something always happens. Sometimes it's self-inflicted, sometimes it's not. Like, he thought that going to Golden State would get him the recognition as being the best player in the world, and he would get those championships, and he would wind up being hater-proof. He went to Golden State and realized it was always going to be Steph's team, and the adulation that he thought was going to come from winning never happened. I think he thought after that, okay, cool. Well, I'll leave here, right? I can go out here in free agency. I'll be the top dog in free agency. I'll sign somewhere and then I'll go there and I'll be that guy. And now after an Achilles tear, the worst thing quite possibly that could happen to him is for him to go sign somewhere like New York where they are expecting him to be that guy. Because the possibility of him being that guy, first of all, he ain't going to be that guy next year. But whenever it is he comes back, he's going to still be, I think, very good. And I think he's going to still be very good because he's still 7 feet tall with incredible hand-eye coordination and that sick jump shot. He's still going to be really, really hard for anybody to guard, but he's not going to be as explosive as he had been previously. That's not possible coming off that Achilles tear. So, like, if they're expecting the Kevin Durant that we saw before, that's in the past, man. So being that guy in the way that I think he probably envisioned would happen in free agency, that's gone. It's a wrap on that. So now what do you do? Now where do you go? Now how do you handle this? These are going to be the things that he's going to have to deal with inside himself, you know? So yeah, there's basketball stuff, and Kevin Durant always wants us to talk about basketball, but I can't help but look at this and have a whole lot of thought just about the man that is Kevin Durant and how it is that you are going to cope with this. Something else I found interesting too, Gage, you noticed that his mom sent a tweet out about his injury?
Yeah, that was early.
Let me ask you a question. When's the last time you saw Kevin Durant and his mom at a game, after a game, a picture with the two of them?
A couple years, maybe?
Yeah, you see, I'm not sure either. But, you know, she was the real MVP 5 years ago.
She was.
We ain't seen her so much since he went to Golden State. Like, that's how real this is. That she's the one to pop up like, oh, my God, this happened.
Well, I mean, when it came to the finals heading out west, I know she was always on First Take and stuff
in the media. Yeah, First Take. I'm talking about how much you see them.
Yeah, that's a different story.
As a
you're
pair.
Right.
Yeah. No. She around somewhere. Who doesn't want to be on TV? Right? But you ain't really seen her around like that. And she popped up like, this is grave. This is as bad a news as you could ask for a basketball player to somehow endure. And again, he was so good when he was out there. He was so good when he was out there. And I'm reluctant to, like, blame Kerr because Kerr said he was going to play him in short bursts, but those bursts didn't really seem to be short when he had him out there. But, I mean, it sounds like if they had decided they were going to play him in this series and this was going to happen at some point. Like, once that call was made, it was made. It's not a matter, like, okay, you know, Kerr would have sat him down for 2 minutes, that thing would have popped right back into place, and he'd have been cool. No, it's not one of those. It's not it. We just saw one of the greatest players in basketball history who has been in one of the more complex situations that any of us can think of just suffered one of the worst injuries, if not the worst injury, that a basketball player can have. And I do, like, the fan stuff, right? Just for us as people who observe basketball, forget about if you're a fan of the Warriors or anything. Just like if you enjoy basketball, I do hope that we appreciated what Kevin Durant was, because there's been a great tendency for us to evaluate him in the context of what he is not. He is, in a lot of ways, maybe like the hit single that never goes to number one. It just peaks at number two, right? Never had a number one hit. Now he got some jams, things people really love, but he never had that thing go number one. He never quite got to that place. So I do think we need to appreciate what he was. They hadn't made one of those. Before him, they had not made one of those. Like, think about this. You realize how crazy it was that Larry Bird was a 6'9" small forward? Like, Larry Bird played center in college and then turned himself into a 6'9" small forward, a double-double guy, all of those things. Kevin Durant's a 7-foot-tall shooting guard. Like, that's what he is. That's what he was. And he was annoying and everything else. And it's kind of hard to think about him, like, based on the personality types that we typically associate with our athletes. All of that stuff. But we might have watched that dude give his career to try to help this team that has never really seemed to really like having him around that much in the first place a faint chance at a championship, right? Because they were down 3-1. It was a faint chance at a championship. And he went out there and did it. I just hope he can live with everything that happened as a result. Oh, yeah, yeah. Speaking of that basketball game, the game 5, I was getting to the end of it. I was like, damn, man, because if there's a game 7 in Toronto, I'm going to try to get up there. But it was looking at the end. Kawhi was on fire. Kawhi, fire. See, I did that. It was Kawhi. He was on fire. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess there's not going to be a game seven. And then the Warriors came out there, started knocking down those shots, and boom, they pulled out that win. And can you believe they won that game? I felt like, if nothing else, the Warriors demonstrated to me an amazing desire. I was blown away in the second half by the way those old dudes were hitting the floor. I was blown away by the sheer intensity that the Warriors showed, because I've talked about this before with the Warriors, is that normally when teams like get to this championship point, we think about them as the medal and, you know, the championship medal and the fire in the belly and stuff like that, the grit, like all those things. We don't really think of the Warriors in those terms, and I think it's in part because the Warriors are the first team that we think of as a real jump shooting team to win championships. We think of them as a finesse team. We think of them as a squad that when they win, it's on the basis of execution. They won this game grinding. Grinding, I tell you, grinding. Now, I want to be fair. The Warriors did come out here and hit something like 50% of their threes. Yeah, they're 20 for 42 from three-point range. Yeah, 48% from three. Okay. Gotta say, that's pretty good. And they still nearly lost that game, which of course has to be a disheartening thing. If you are the Warriors and think that you could, like, that's best case scenario right there. 20 for 42 from three, that's best case scenario. And you still almost lost that game, but they won that game because them dudes wanted it so damn bad. They are all over the floor trying to get this. Kevon Looney, that dude's out there playing with, like, what was it, dislodged cartilage or whatever it is between his collarbone and his first rib. That dude was out there going so hard, like he's laying on the ground screaming, crying. And so for me, the Warriors, even if they lose this series, right, and I still think they're going to lose it, but even if they lose this series, this to me, I imagine, had to be what it was like for a lot of people when they saw Ali lose to Joe Frazier in 1971. And when I say that, I don't mean the people who were Ali fans. I mean the people who didn't like Ali coming into it. Like, I find that this happens in boxing as much as any other sport, where the way you lost will change the respect that people have for you. Right? Like, you standing in there, taking those blows, getting knocked down, getting back up and still going at it. That's a great way as a boxer to get respect. In fact, maybe in some ways, a better way to get respect than actually winning. And so when we think about things getting hard for the Warriors, it's like, yeah, okay, they came back for 3-1 against Oklahoma City, right? But I don't think we give them points on that for being like, yo, back against the wall, we decided we wasn't gonna lose. They don't get a whole lot of points on that one. But even those of us who are more inclined to, like, level-headed analysis, whether that be using quantitative means or otherwise, like, I'm not a guy that really gets into all the cliches and stuff like that, but I felt like the way the Warriors performed deserved all of them. That was all of that heart of a champion stuff, right? That was all of that we refuse to lose. That was all of that we've done this before. All those things, right? That was all theirs. That was all them. And they came out there and they made that happen. DeMarcus Cousins, who can barely jump over a piece of paper anymore. Bruh, DeMarcus Cousins, it looked like in order to dunk, he got to cheat. They called him on a goaltend. In order to block a shot, he got to cheat. He got called for another goaltend on something else. He ain't really doing so good at setting screens. Like, he's out there looking old and he's looking done. Dude, DeMarcus Cousins scored 14 points last night. And a lot of that scoring 14 points was he went out there and he got it. Like, this is a dude that for his whole career has been a 30% usage rate sort of player. He's out here just trying to get in where he fits in, hope to get a switch and somebody front him so he can throw the ball over and then he can go out there and he can get it. Like, they made this happen. And on the other side, they were playing against a team that outside of Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green is a bunch of guys that ain't never done this before. And they were close enough to getting that championship that they could taste it. They were up by like six. Nick Nurse called that strange timeout. Like, I don't buy into the idea of momentum, but I don't think. What'd he say he called that timeout just because they were going to lose it if he didn't call it or something like that?
There's some people that said it was actually Lowry that called the timeout, but I cannot confirm this.
Yeah, whoever did, bad play, bad move. By the way, that dude Nick Nurse ran a triangle in two. Did you see that?
I saw it and immediately thought of you.
He went from running a box in one to a triangle in two, and now I got a co-host on TV who somehow thinks that running a box in one is a courageous act of basketball, and I'm like, oh man, you were never on the team. And I don't mean that to be like, yo, you ain't never played basketball. I mean, no way anybody respects a box in one. There's never any respect for running a box in one. Like, the triangle in two, I'm not much better with, but the box in one? The box in one? Box just could not believe they ran a boxing one. I don't care how much you say it worked. It was a damn boxing one. And by the way, an indictment of Steve Kerr that when they ran the boxing one in game four, he was like, oh, I need to hurry up and get Clay out there. You couldn't come up with nothing for a boxing one? Are you serious? What was I talking about before I got caught up talking about this damn boxing one? Rappers are close enough to taste it. Blew it. They should have won this game. Like, at this point, there's no reason for them to lose to the Warriors other than if the Warriors just wanted more or the Warriors are made of something different. That's it, right? With no Durant and everything else, nah, man. Nah. Like, if the Raptors lose this, this is an epic all-time collapse if they lose this series. It is an indefensible collapse if they lose this series. No way around it. None. Again, I don't think they're actually going to lose this series. But I was stunned by the end that Game 5 did not end this series. I was really, really stunned. I thought they had it at that point. And again, I think the Raptors got reason to feel encouraged. The Warriors had their lights out 3-point game, right? The Warriors got good game, a great game from Steph, and I'd say a good game from Klay Thompson. They got a lot out of it. This thing is still going on. Gabe, listen to this, man. Iguodala, 5 points. Kevon Looney, 4 points. Sean Livingston, no points. Quinn Cook, 3 points. Like, Draymond had 10. It would not surprise me if the Warriors' next game had literally 4 players who scored.
Yeah, what's amazing about it is you read that stat line and you think, oh, that's a Warriors loss, and oh, players like that have to perform better if they're going to win.
Yes, but at the same time, you see the Warriors stat line, and you think if they went 20 for 42, it's a blowout from 3-point range.
Yep.
You think it's a blowout. They don't have it. Like, Steph, as much as I think Steph played really well, but I also felt like Steph had to do a lot of bailout, right? He had to take a lot of just bailout threes because we're not going to be able to get any points otherwise. And what happens here, and this is just to me where the Warriors are and why I ain't got no shade or no beef with anybody, is that these teams they run out of gas, man. Like, year after year after year after year after for a championship run, and each of them championships, the second one don't feel as good as the first, the third don't feel as good as the second, and all the way down the line, and they're still grinding, and they're still going. Like, this is it. This is what happens to teams like this. The time just kind of runs out. Like, the one thing about Jordan by leaving after those three-peats is we never saw those teams get to that point where they were just on fumes. It didn't happen. The Warriors, they've been there. And this all also, by the way, I think the big carryover we can't lose sight of. Draymond gave Kevin Durant those blues earlier. We don't need you, da-da-da, everything else. They need the hell out of Kevin Durant right now. And now he's hurt. And I wonder how Draymond Green feels and thinks about all of these things. Everything he had to say about Durant and everything else, now it's full circle for him right here. Full circle. You don't need that dude? All right, you go out here and put up 35. Because they're going to need somebody else that's able to score points. And I don't know where they're going to get those points from, home or away. I don't know how they're going to do it. And I tell you, boy, it's going to be wildly embarrassing and terrible for the Warriors if they close out that building at home with an L. And that whole time, they'll be looking around and being like, damn, I sure wish Kevin Durant was here. Hey, we'll be back to talk about analytics and basketball in just a second. But first, average interest rates on credit card debt are over 19% APR. Have you looked at your interest rate lately? Refinance with a credit card consolidation loan from LightStream. It's an easy way to save hundreds to thousands of dollars and lower your interest rate. LightStream offers credit card consolidation loans from 5.95% APR with autopay, lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. There are absolutely no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. LightStream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Just for my listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to LightStream.com/Bomani. LightStream.com/Bomani. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit LightStream.com/Bomani for more information. All right, so this interesting thing happened the other day, right? Doing a little TV, And Jalen Rose had done this interview with The New Yorker. And they were talking about analytics in basketball. And the writer, Isaac, I think it's Chotiner, C-H-O-T-I-N-E-R. I'm assuming it's Chotiner. I don't know how to pronounce it. And I'm just reading it off a piece of paper. But Chotiner was talking to Jalen about this, the use of analytics in basketball. And Jalen is like, look, man, as there is a priority on analytics in these front offices, it's going to box out players from having an opportunity to work with NBA teams and to work in front offices. And correct me if I'm wrong. He also said that, you know, that there are some kind of, you know, racial connotations and ramifications of this. And that's what he's like. He did say that in the story, right?
He did.
Okay. Of course, when you start doing that, how can math be racist? You know, and everything, right, pops up and says these things. And I thought that Jalen did very well. I don't want to say did very well because that feels patronizing. But in the interview with Chotiner, where Jalen makes the point, he's like, look, analytics are a tool. It is a wrench, but it is not the whole box. It has to be used with other factors, and these other factors do matter. And so, again, Chotiner, and Chotiner's rep on these things is to kind of give these kind of pushback interviews. But Jalen was making the point that is like, I got these guys who never played basketball, and they know these numbers, and they can manipulate these spreadsheets. And these guys are looking at me like I don't know anything about basketball because they know some numbers. And then next thing you know, the guy, the writer in this case is basically doing the same thing to Jalen. Right? Like the whole way it was just like, yo, you're doing exactly the thing that he said in this. And so we got on High Noon and we did a larger discussion of some of the matters that were involved in this. And it went around. It was kind of a big thing. And I said this thing about the Sloan Conference. I looked at Pablo and I'm like, they invite you to do stuff at Sloan. I was like, they invited me to be on a panel about activism. And I got two master's degrees in economics. I asked Pablo, what do they have you doing? And I think I kind of made Pablo a little nervous because, you know, them Sloan people is his friends. And I was like, so what do they have you do? Well, I am a moderator, but it is on. You feel what I'm saying? I get it. I want to talk a little bit more about that because we just kind of ran through that kind of quick. And I didn't really have a chance to kind of spell out some things that I think are a little deeper about this. And I want to make sure that my take on this is understood to be a bit more balanced than you may have thought than when I saw on television. Right. All right. Point one. Former players have to stop rejecting quantified data. They have to stop. Like, this is a big thing that former players have to understand that these numbers have value. And what they need to understand is that fundamentally they believe that these numbers have value because there are numbers that athletes absolutely value. And this is not just athletes, by the way. This is all people who kind of reject some of the advanced quantitative data that we're using in sports now. All of them have value for numbers. What you need to do is get a value on better numbers. And if you don't believe that these guys have a value on numbers, you need to sit by an NBA scores table sometime and see them cats come over there and be like, yo, I should have gotten an assist on that last play. Right? Like, you got no problem with counting points. You got no problem with counting rebounds. You got no reason and no problem with counting assists, steals, blocks, whatever these are. You have no problem counting those things up and then using them as evidence to make whatever case it is that you make, right? What the other side is saying, and on this matter, I'm definitely on the other side. What the other side is saying is that those numbers don't give you an accurate representation of what is actually going on. But what we can do here is we can make some moves that kind of isolate some variables. And then we'll give you better answers. Because one thing I'll tell you, some of these guys on these points and stuff like that, if one of them dudes was averaging like 22 points a game, but it was on a slow-paced team, they would be quick to point out to you that they 22 points really means more than 22 points because of how slow they play. Like, people get it. They understand it. But what people don't like is things they don't understand. And I think that something that has happened with this movement around the analytics is that it is presented as being the super high-minded intellectual stuff that only a select number of people can understand. And that select number of people definitely wouldn't include former players or current players, because how could they understand all this high and mighty mathematics? Dog, I got news for you. People that's ultimately making these decisions, they understand what those numbers mean. They're not out here cranking out equations and working on how to derive these numbers. Like, do you think the people that are actually in charge of making decisions on this kind of stuff for these basketball teams are really out here, like, doing the math, scratching out all the work to make sure that they've got the best, best linear unbiased estimator? Like, do you think that they're out here doing that? No, they're not doing that. People are putting those numbers together in ways and things that they can understand, and then they're going and making decisions off of those, right? So that's why I say, like, with these guys, they're like, nah, I don't need that stuff. No, the thing I don't think most of these guys get is that overwhelmingly, the advanced numbers back up what your eyes see. You know, like, you go look at these metrics that people use to determine, you know, like these catch all sorts of metrics for players and stuff like that. Go look at us at the top of those lists, man. It's generally the dudes that are at the top of the game, right? Like, it is very rare that the analytics are going to tell you something about a player that you're not able to see. But what they can give you is a little bit better detail. And what they can tell you are the better ways to use players. And what are the most efficient ways to get the most out of your basketball team, right? Like, you start with a hypothesis. This is how I think basketball should be played. This is what I think is the best way to go about winning. You get out here and you test that hypothesis. You test the hypothesis on the court, but then you can also test that hypothesis via the math. And just see what you come up with. More information is always better. And so I do think that it is important that everybody involved in this have some basic understanding of how these numbers are used and what they are used for. Because there's no way that they cannot be helpful to anybody who has access to them. But we also have to stop being so dramatic about the brilliance of the people who do use these numbers. Sometimes they use them wisely. Sometimes they do not. But the willingness to use those numbers is not an indication of how smart you are. It's just not. You can go out there and you can get your pencil pushing nerd types to go out here and come up with all this stuff. What you really need to have, though, are people who have ideas of like, hey, man, I need to know insert piece of information here, right? I need to know this thing. Guys, how do we find this out? Like, so here are the players that are available on the market. Come out here and tell me what it is that these guys do really well. And what you want to have is people with the brains that are able to come up with the best ways to isolate the various things that guys do very well and to cut away from the noise that's in any equation. And I don't mean equation on a page. I mean like an equation in life, anything that's going, get the noise out of the way so you can focus on the thing that you're trying to pay attention to. Right? There's nothing, no reason for people to not do that. But I'm telling you, that doesn't take no MIT graduate in order to do. It doesn't, you know? And so you get caught with this idea that, okay, well, we need to get these guys with Ivy League degrees in order to run a basketball team? Are you kidding me? In order to run a basketball team, you think you need somebody with an Ivy League degree in order to do that? You think you need somebody with some advanced math degree in order to do that? Because you don't. You don't. And this is where this gets to be like fuzzy and messed up, is that you don't need those degrees in order to do the jobs that we are talking about. But it seems more and more that teams are setting themselves up to where a prerequisite to get those jobs is one of those degrees. Now, if a prerequisite for a job is something that does not necessarily need to be in place, then you have to ask the question, why are we putting this prerequisite in place? Right? So let me give you a little story. I remember this once, when I was a kid, there's this, one of the office president at the school my mama worked at. They, wanted to hire a woman to be a secretary there. And that was specifically who they wanted to hire. And they wanted to do it fast. So they didn't want to put themselves in a position where they'd have to go through some deep process and wade through all these applicants in order for that person to have the job. And so what they did was they put a specification on that, on the listing, that said that the person applying for that job needed to have previous experience in, I can't remember what the office was, but like call it the governor's office. It wasn't the governor, but just say it. Like, in order to get this job, you need to have experience working in the governor's office. It just so happened that the woman that they wanted to hire for that job used to work in the governor's office. Which is to say, when people set up arbitrary prerequisites, it is to exclude. Now, if we are going to say that you need to have these Ivy League degrees and you need to have this deep math background in order to do this, the people with the Ivy League degrees, overwhelmingly, not black. The people with these advanced degrees in quantitative fields, overwhelmingly, not black. Do you think that these specifications that are thrown out here and these prerequisites, do you think it is coincidental that they're picking these things that don't involve black people? Do you? Because I got a couple hundred years and change of history to indicate that those things are rarely, if ever, coincidental. Rarely, if ever, coincidental. So like I was on TV and I was talking a bit about STEM education, you know, and all that stuff and how that ties into this. But STEM education, like we got to do better in this country on educating basically people who are neither white nor Asian. We got to do a better job on the way that we educate them on math and the way we treat them on math. And where I do think this comes up in this matter is black folks in particular. I can't speak to what the experience is for our Latino brothers and sisters. I don't have the same like firsthand understanding of how that goes. So some of you who have that, feel free to send me an email, tell your story, whatever it is. But I can tell you, black folks are not encouraged to do those things. We are treated as though those are things that we are not able to do. Right. That's how it goes. Now, as the years have gone on, there's been a greater emphasis on getting people into engineering and stuff like that. And so, like, I grew up hanging out at Prairie View A&M University. It's the, you know, strong engineering program over there. Like, all of that. There's a lot of places that's getting the engineering and all. But as younger people, man, we are not encouraged to do these things. That's why there's such an emphasis on stuff like coding and everything else, because for so long we ain't never been encouraged to do those sorts of things. And then by the time, you know, you're like, oh, I got something I want to do with this math, it's too late. Now, part of this is that we're Americans and we're morons, and therefore we think that, like, we don't realize that learning things for their own sake is important. And, like, I'm just doing this to get a job or whatever, and you never know what job you might need later. No need to try to train your brain or anything like that. But we don't get pushed in those directions. We don't. And so what you wind up with is, once again, a system that steers us away and lets the white folks have all the juice, lets the white folks have all the power. They're the ones that get to make all the decisions. Like, that's where this pushes up. This is where we wind up. And that's that's not cool, especially not when you're dealing with an industry where no matter how much money people in the industry are making, when one set of people is working with their bodies and another side is working with their brains, woo, that's a bit dangerous, guys. That is a bit dangerous. Now, are you familiar with, what's his name? Bill James?
Yes, I am.
All right. So Bill James, you know, at the forefront of the sabermetrics in baseball and everything else. And I think he has a job now with one of these teams. I think with the Red Sox. This is a quote you can never forget that Bill James gave about players. He said right here, and I quote, "If the players all retired tomorrow, we would replace them. The game would go on. In 3 years, it would make no difference whatsoever. The players are not the game any more than the beer vendors are." That is a prevalent sort of attitude that comes out of this analytics sort of camp, because what happens with the analytics guys is once they reduce these games just down to equations and all they care about when they watch it is efficiency and who is optimizing this and who is optimizing that, like this, that's the only lens through which you view the game. Now, granted, I don't blame you if your job's about winning, then you're going to look at the game through the lens of winning. But I think you understand what I'm saying is that if that's the only way that you are out here looking at this stuff, then you're going to reduce the players to being less than human. There's no way around that. And what happens very often with these quantitative guys, and Daryl Morey is a fantastic example of this, they struggle with the human stuff when it comes to basketball. You can look at some of the chemistry disasters that Daryl Morey has put together since he's been in Houston, because he doesn't think about people stuff. I've had people tell me like how awkward it is for them to watch Morey try to figure out how to interact with players because he doesn't get it in that way. Because this is just like a puzzle to guys like these. That's all it is. It's just a puzzle for them. And so if you have these guys that are inclined to just look at it like it's a puzzle, how are they then looking at the players like pieces? Like assets. And so when these pieces and when these assets are done playing, how do you think that these teams are going to look at them when they try to get jobs working for the team? If they never respected them that much in the first place, if they never respected their knowledge, if they never respected the things that they provide on the court, the things that they could pick up tacitly from being out there, right? What could they do? Like, you know what this is like with a lot of these guys here? Like, I'm a big, 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 big music guy, for those of you who know. Read a lot of books about music, do all that stuff, right? And, like, I'm fascinated. I just got through reading this biography of Aretha Franklin by David Ritz called Respect that I do recommend. And I get so swept up when I hear about, like, the processes and being in the studio and putting the producer together and getting the band together and all of these things. Like, I love that stuff. It's fantastic. But, like, Jerry Wexler that worked at Atlantic Records, I'm sure he believed, and rightly, that he knew how to put together a band, how to put together a studio session, how to put together a tour, all of that stuff. That dude, for a minute, though, you think he ever thought he knew more about music than Aretha Franklin did? No. No. He had a place for her input and knew that you couldn't put her all the way in charge necessarily, but there's a respect for what she provided and what she had to bring and what it doesn't feel like from fans and people in the league who were all around this quantitative process stuff. It doesn't seem to be an actual respect for the players. That was the problem I had with Hinkie and what he was doing in Philadelphia. It was so obvious he had no respect for the people he was throwing out there on the floor, asking them to lose, to get their asses kicked game after game after game. That's what you do when you ain't got no respect for these cats, when you don't value or appreciate what they actually do, when you think that you are the star. And so what we get in basketball, and you see it in other sports, we really get this in basketball, man, is that these guys in these numbers, they want to be the stars. They want to see themselves as the ones who are responsible for success. And let me tell you something to never, ever forget about sports in general and really basketball in particular. Those dudes who are playing are the show. They are the reason why we are here. They are the reason why this is fun. They are the reason why this is exhilarating. They are the rarer commodity that is out here on the floor. The players are everything. Everything. And if I were you, I would be skeptical of anybody who tries to tell you otherwise. Because guess what? I find that the people who try to tell you that the game is not the players, they're not trying to tell you that it's just somebody else that matters most. They're trying to say they themselves are the ones who matter most. Don't nobody follow you through the mall. Don't nobody say ooh and ah when you click send on the trade. Don't nobody do that. And so, yeah, you may have thought that you've optimized what basketball is. That don't mean you're making it better. For one, and two, y'all don't know everything, and it's okay to not know everything. But ask yourself when you watch all these cats, why are they so dedicated to telling everybody how they're the ones that really know? Part of it is about saying how dope they are. Another part is about saying how not dope everybody else is. And why do they care so much about that?
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from tech.
This is Hamza Shaban with the Washington Post. What if scammers could learn your password not from a massive cyber attack or taking control of your device, but from listening in as you type? That's the startling premise of a recent study where researchers were able to glean passwords by deciphering the sound waves generated by fingers tapping on smartphone touchscreens. Malicious actors can decode what a person is typing by using a spying app that can access a phone's microphone. The researchers demonstrated the attack can successfully recover PIN codes, letters, and whole words. A passive sound-based attack could be executed if a person installs an app infected with such malware. Attackers could also provide their target with a smartphone on which the malicious app was pre-installed. The researchers designed a machine learning algorithm that could decode vibrations for specific keystrokes. Among a test group of 45 people, the researchers could correctly guess passwords on smartphones 7 times out of 27 within 10 attempts. On tablets, the researchers achieved better results, nailing the password 19 times out of 27 within 10 attempts. To guard against such attacks, the researchers said smartphone makers might consider installing a switch that would allow users to shut off the microphone. Another option is to simply make it more obvious when the microphone is on by flashing a light or an icon on the screen. The research fits into a broader study of security vulnerabilities that exploit a device's built-in sensors, like cameras and accelerometers, to extract personal information from users without their knowledge.
So you're saying that they can hear me put my password in, and like, bop, bop, bop. That's what they're doing?
Yeah, this brings a whole new level to the tinfoil hat stuff.
Dude, we're doomed.
I mean, if they can listen to you through your microphone, we've heard other stories like where Amazon Alexa is listening into people and recording it and then sending it to their bosses and stuff. I mean, I see people at work, and I can't remember if before I mentioned that my dad puts tape over his camera on his phone.
He's that guy.
Yeah, he's that guy. I clown him a little bit for it, but now, I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to put a piece of tape over the microphone? You need that thing. It is a phone.
I don't want to have this thing anymore.
At least on the computer, for the most part, it has a little light that indicates when your camera is on. It does not on your phone, but there's no way to see. I mean, that's what Hamza was saying. There's no way to see whether or not your microphone is physically on. So it's like up to the phone companies to kind of restore trust here.
I'm scared.
All right, this next story comes from Artificial Intelligence.
Hey, this is Drew Harwell. I cover artificial intelligence at the Washington Post. And I just wrote about the robots of Walmart. There are floor scrubbing, shelf scanning, box sorting robots that are rolling out to hundreds of Walmart stores across the country. And they are part of the biggest experiment yet into how normal humans and robots will interact in the store and workplace. But there's something interesting happening here, where it's the human workers who are having to work alongside the robots who are having maybe the toughest time. They kind of expected that robots would take their job one day, but in the meantime, they're kind of having to work alongside these floor scrubbing, self-driving robots, and they're finding them kind of annoying. The robots are fickle, they can get easily confused, and shoppers often get confused around the robots too. We heard from one Walmart employee who said that a man fell asleep on top of one of the self-driving floor cleaner robots, and another Walmart employee had to pull him off. This just goes to show that in this strange time we live in, we're going to have to be sort of working alongside robot colleagues more often, and we don't always know how to deal with them and how to interact, and we're not always really prepared for the kind of strange ways that the robots act around our normal human world. So it's going to be interesting to see how kind of these superstores and other businesses find a way to move robots into the workplace in a way that doesn't annoy people and is still sort of useful.
Yeah, I never really thought about what it would be like to have to like work with the robots. Can you take a robot to HR?
I would imagine you'd be able to report them.
Yeah, man. Like after a point, man, them robots going to start getting frisky and doing wrong.
What's sad, too, is like with Walmart, you know, they got rid of the greeter. The idea was that they wanted to replace that position with someone who could do more things around that were like a little bit more active. And it kind of sounds like they replaced him with the robots. What's funny about it, to me at least, is that a lot of the complaints that they're having about these robots, they get easily confused, takes them a long time to learn. Kind of sounds like a senior citizen, am I wrong?
Yeah, but I mean, yo, we got to get these old folks out the house. It don't make you feel good when the old man tell you hi and coming into old Walmart.
It does.
Yeah, like you, no. Yo, man, all these jobs we getting rid of, people still going to need jobs. I wish at some point that people understood this. But no, it's going to be like, I just can't imagine. I'm at the coffee maker. Next thing I know, R2-D2 just walking. I don't even know if they walk. Just walking past. Yo, like, we are in the future. This is the future. The future has arrived. The future is frightening. The future is not good. The future looks a lot better on the Jetsons, right? That's one thing I feel like, is that the Jetsons didn't really be like, and now you're all going to be forced out. They always had room for the people on the Jetsons. Ain't no room for y'all left.
Yeah, there has to be some value in that human interaction, right?
You would think, but that's one thing. If there will be any undoing of the human species, is that we don't appreciate the value of each other.
All right, this last story comes from Psych.
This is Dr. Vanessa Cutler. Feeling stressed? It might be making your dog stressed, too. A recent study published in Sweden suggests that dogs may mirror the stress levels of their owners. Researchers looked at several pairs of dogs with female owners and found that with the exception of dogs who have anxious owners, dogs' cortisol levels tended to rise when their owners' cortisol levels rose. And they found this relationship to be true over the course of a year. Anxious owners, or owners who rated themselves as being more neurotic, actually had dogs with lower cortisol levels. The researchers attributed this finding to a strong attachment between more anxious owners and their dogs, and said that in the long run, this bond may facilitate lower stress levels and better health for both people and their pets. Cortisol is a hormone that is used as a surrogate marker for stress, and it's an important part of the stress response, but it doesn't necessarily explain the whole picture, as cortisol increases for other reasons beyond stress too, like to regulate the body's wake and sleep cycle. Likewise, not all kinds of stress are necessarily bad for people or for dogs, and more research will be necessary before saying for certain whether the associated rise in cortisol levels are detrimental to health. These results also lead to further questions about interspecies dynamics, particularly how emotions are shared by two individuals, or what's known as the theory of emotional contagion. This is the first study to demonstrate long-term synchronization of stress levels between humans and dogs.
So basically what they're saying is y'all out here making y'all's dogs miserable?
Sounds like it. I mean, this certainly the study is not entirely conclusive, and because it's the first one, there's still more work to be done. But it kind of sounds like that, doesn't it?
But no, it makes sense, right? Like, you know, so you have people who wound up in these relationships where they're like, yeah, I need this person, needs stabilizing force, he helps me hold it together, you know, he or she helps me hold it together, whatever it is. But like, what's happening while that person's holding it together? You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, nobody's like, yo, that sure made me feel better. It's not really, that's not really how it works. Y'all out here making y'all's dogs feel bad. That's a shame. Like, oh, he loves to make me feel better. And sometimes that dog be like, damn, here you go again. Fine.
Put my nose on your chin. Look at me.
And dog's like, fine. Damn, like at some point, so when you going to do this for me?
Meanwhile, like when I'm like upset at my house, my cat just looks at me and like goes and hides underneath the bed.
I can see that.
He's not having any part of it.
Yeah, that's not, as a species, they're not really so much, and they do it different.
You're conclusive in the opinion that it would be a dog if you had to get an animal, correct?
I guess, probably. Maybe a hamster. Who knows?
Maybe a hamster.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not really that keen on the idea of an animal in my house. Like, we be all beyond that.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. So in light of all of the wonderful kawaii tales, whether they were tall tales or whether they were truth, we've been blessed with a great number of them. So what we thought we might do is put out to the listeners to give us their best kawaii tall tales. So I'm going to put them forward to you. And then you'll have to decide whether it's true or false. And then I'm going to hit a little buzzer if you are wrong. And I'm going to hit a little ding if you're right. Sound good?
Cool.
All right. This first one comes from Alex in Sacramento.
Hey, what up, Gabe and Bo? This is Alex in Sacramento. I have a story about kawaii. So my homie was visiting a friend who was rooming with kawaii at San Diego State. He said that all kawaii does is watch Martin DVDs and play on the PlayStation. But if you wanted to play on the PlayStation or watch something else besides Martin, you had to go out and score back-to-back buckets on Kawhi before he passed you the sticks, or you got to wait till he left. Well, this time, they was posted up, and they wanted to get on the new Madden, but, of course, Kawhi was watching the Martin DVDs. So after about three or four Martin, my homie was like, all right, we got to play for this. So they go out, and, of course, it works out about as well as you think it would. It didn't go well for him. But the coldest part of the story is, every time my homie tried to get a shot up, Kawhi would swat it and go, damn, Gina, in that Kawhi voice.
So hold up. He said that you'd have to get back-to-back buckets of Kawhi to get back all the sticks.
Yeah, to stop him from watching Martin and playing PlayStation.
And then he did it. He said, damn, Gina. I'm going to say it's true. Ah, too bad.
That's where, like, he had me until the damn Gina.
You've never watched Martin, have you?
I'm revealing myself here.
Yeah. Age.
Age is a thing. 91.
Okay, yeah. Age.
This next one comes from Blake in Atlanta.
Hey, Bomani, this is Blake from Atlanta. My friend Morgan lives in Houston. Went to a San Antonio game a few years back. Stayed at some nice hotel. Anyway, he's coming in. There's one of those, like, pianos somewhere, like, in the lobby. Kawhi Leonard's playing, like, this perfect, I don't really know classical music. He's playing something I call it my phone. He's just absolutely, like, Mozart 7 coming. It was apparently beautiful to hear.
Gonna say no.
Let me give you a ding here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, now you had not prepared for success.
Yeah. Well,
much better.
Yeah, there we go. All right, this last one. This guy didn't say where he was from, but his name is Lon.
Yo, this is Lon. Man, my story about Kawhi comes back from my days when I was at school with him down in San Diego State. A lot of times people think San Diego, beautiful place, lots to do. I mean, the weather's great, but it can get kind of boring at times. So what we would do oftentimes, go down to Mexico, right? Get it popping. Great time every time, you know? One of the downsides about going to Mexico, though, is coming back. Because if you have somebody who's trying to get some cash or whatever, you know, the system ain't necessarily always the most above board, shall we say. So one of the times that we went down there, Kawhi was with us, you know, and it's like, he's a big man on campus. Everybody knows about dude. But he's super quiet. I heard different things about him from teammates and whatnot because I was cool with a lot of them, but not really Kawhi because he don't talk a lot. So anyway, we go down to Mexico and we're doing it big in Tijuana, or as big as we can do it because, I mean, we're in college, so we broke, right? But we come back and, yeah, they were just taxing, like, nah, you're not coming back over here. They said that we had broken into some store. Didn't happen, but they said, you know, everybody was going to have to pay $200 to get back, right? At that time, me, most of my homeboys didn't have it. But Kawhi, he was able to come back, right? Because, like I said, big men on campus, somebody fronted him the money, right? So it's all good. We come back after spending the weekend in Tijuana because we were in jail there. And what does Kawhi say? Border man was getting paid, huh? Yeah. That's really what it said. Border man gets paid. I didn't understand what that whole thing was until one of his teammates was like, oh, yeah, it's just something he says. He says border man gets paid all the time, blah, blah. So it's just crazy that this is how it went down.
Can't be true.
You're right about that one. I thought I'd slip you up by putting in three stories that were false.
Yeah, nice try, buddy.
The thing about it was is that all of the ones that were good were the ones that were fake. I think we've run out of Kawhi tall tales that are good at this point.
Yeah, we've heard every story there is to hear about him. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thanks to our sponsor, Lightstream. Also, thanks to our contributors to If You Haven't Heard. Thanks to Hamza Shaban of The Washington Post. Check out his story on how the hackers are using the microphone on your phone in order to get your passwords. That's scary. Thanks to Drew Harwell of The Washington Post. Check out his story on how the employees at Walmart are getting a little tired of the robot employees and how they kind of messing up the program. And thank you to Dr. Vanessa Cutler. She writes about psychology for ABC News. Check out her story about how your stress is stressing out your dog. Be sure to check out the Mina Kimes show this week. She'll be starting her division previews with Charles McDonald of SB Nation. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we will talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.